Shri Shri Man, His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki, His Khan Founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki, Raj Granth Srimad Bhagavatam Ki, Hari Nam Sankirtan Ki, Vitahe Gaur Primanandi, Glories to the Assembled Devotees, Glories to the Assembled Devotees, All Glories to Shri Guru and Shri Gauranga, All Glories to Shri Prabhupada. So today's class title, as was mentioned by Shankar Pandit Prabhu, will be speaking a little about the birth of human life. And we selected one verse from the first canto, second chapter. This chapter is titled Divinity and Divine Service. And so we'll chant the verse and then we'll try to elaborate some of these points. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Kamasya Dendriya Vritir Labdho Jiveta Yavata Jivasya Tattva Jignyasa Narto Yas Cheha Karmabihi
Vasyanendriya Pritir Abdo Jivete Yavata Jivasya Tatva Jigyasa Narto Yasche Hagarma Bahi Kamasyanendriya Pritir Abdo Jivete Yavata Jivasya Tatva Jigyasa Narto Yasche Hagarma Bahi Yavata, so much so. Jivasya, of the living being. Tatva, the absolute truth. Jigyasa, inquiries. Na, not. Artha, end. Yacha iha, whatsoever else. Karma bhi, by occupational activities. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Life's desires should never be directed towards sense gratification. One should desire only a healthy life or self-preservation. Since a human being is meant for inquiry about the absolute truth, nothing else should be the goal of one's works. Report. The completely bewildered material civilization is wrongly directed towards the fulfillment of desires and sense gratification. In such civilization, in all spheres of life, the ultimate end is sense gratification. In politics, social service, altruism, philanthropy, and ultimately even in religion or even in salvation, the same tint of sense gratification is ever increasingly prominent. In the political field, the leaders of men fight with one another to fulfill their personal sense gratification. The voters adore their so-called leaders only when they promise sense gratification. As soon as the voters are dissatisfied in their own sense satisfaction, they dethrone the leaders. The leaders must always disappoint the voters by not satisfying their senses. The same is applicable in all other fields. No one is serious about the problems of life. Even those who are on the path of salvation desire to become one with the absolute truth and desire to commit spiritual suicide for sense gratification. But the Bhagavatam says that one should not live for sense gratification. One should satisfy the senses only in so much as required for self-preservation and not for sense gratification. Because the body is made of senses, which also require a certain amount of satisfaction, there are regulative directions for satisfaction of the senses. But the senses are not meant for unrestricted enjoyment. For example, marriage or the combination of a man with a woman is necessary for children, but is not meant for sense enjoyment. In the absence of voluntary restraint, there is propaganda for family planning. But foolish persons do not know that family planning is automatically executed as soon as there is a search after the absolute truth. Seekers of the absolute truth are never allured by unnecessary engagements in sense gratification, because the serious students seeking the absolute truth are always overwhelmed with the work of researching the absolute truth. In every sphere of life, therefore, the ultimate end must be seeking after the absolute truth. And that sort of engagement will make one happy, because he will be less engaged in the varieties of sense gratification. And what that absolute truth is explained as follows. End of purport. Please repeat. Life's desires should not be directed towards sense gratification. One should desire only a healthy life or self-preservation, since a human being is meant for inquiry about the absolute truth. Nothing else should be the goal of one's works. Om Agyan Timirandasya Ina Jina Salakaya Chaksu Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Tadanti Swam Padanti Kam Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sri Vasavi Gaur Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare. So we've chosen one particular subject matter, the goal of human life. And first of all, we need to understand the value of human life and the rarity of human life, and that will give us a little bit of understanding of the actual goal. The Vedic literatures explain that there are 8,400,000 species of life. And these 8,400,000 are broken down into various categories. There are 900,000 species of aquatics. There are 1,100,000 species of birds. And there are 1 million plants, trees, creepers. There are 2 million bugs, insects, reptiles, those lower forms of animals, lower than the four-legged. And then there are 3 million species of four-legged animals. And then there are 400,000 varieties of human beings. Of course, this not simply means on this planet. If you were to research this type of evidence, you would not find these different varieties on this particular planet. Vedic literature deals with the entire material cosmic creation. And so these are spread throughout the different universes on different planets. But it explains in the Vedic literature to get a human form of life is very rare. And we can even see from this particular amount of living entities in the various species, we find that the human beings are very less. There are more varieties of other forms of life than there are human beings. Animals, plants, trees, creepers, insects outnumber the human species tremendously in so many proportions. And it is also explained that out of the 400,000 species of human life, very few are actually civilized. Very few are civilized. So to get a human form of life, is considered by Vedic scriptures to be very rare. The living entity falls from the spiritual world, and gradually it takes its position in the very, very basic forms of life. And gradually it evolves through so many thousands and thousands of years and thousands of births from one species to another. Finally, it comes to the human form. Finally. The animal species of life are characterized by simply satisfying the basic gross needs of the body, such as eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. These are considered to be animal propensities. If you study practically the animal kingdom, you'll find that the majority of the animals are engaged in these types of activities. And they are working very strictly under the direction of the material energy. Material energy is keeping the lower forms of life in such a way that they are actually performing their bodily needs in a regulated way, practically. And this is God's arrangement. To come to the human form of life is rare. To come to the human form of life is rare. It is very rare. And therefore, the scriptures say, Atato Brahma Jigyasa, there is a purpose for the human form of life. There is a purpose for the human form of life. If the living entity simply is satisfied with the base activities that are there within the animal life, eating, sleeping, mating, and defending, and then one does not really understand what is the goal of human life, or what is the purpose of human life. Because we see that if the human being tries to compete with the animal with these particular basic bodily functions, we find that the animals are more proficient and are more expert at performing these activities. And we find, to use just a bear can sleep sometimes 6 months, they say. Hibernation, right? Bear hibernates for 6 months. Eating. An elephant can eat 100 pounds of food per day, and he has no problem finding the food. Why is that? Because God is making the arrangements for the elephant to receive the necessary food he needs. God makes all the arrangements for the lower species to get whatever they need. Defense. We find that many animals, they have claws, and they have teeth, and of course, they have various means of defense, just like the birds. What do they do when there's some danger? Immediately they fly away. Immediately they fly away. So they are able to defend themselves by God's arrangement. And mating. Many, many animals have greater mating capacities than the human beings, such as the pigeon. The pigeon can mate 60 times in an hour. This has been understood. So if we compare the living being with the animals, we find that these propensities that are natural for both species are very much developed in the animal life. But in the human form of life, if a human being eats a little bit more, what happens? Gets sick. There's some, has to restrict himself. There's some fasting, there's some, maybe some medicine. Sex life, one will destroy one's physical, mental, and emotional, spiritual health if one goes beyond their capacity according to the regulative principles in the scriptures. Now they have artificial means for increasing this particular activity, but it's explained that this only shortens one's life. You have so many breaths. It's explained the living being has so many breaths when he comes into the world. And by engaging in sex life, he's shortening his life by expending more breaths. And of course, the energy and the physical difficulties that are there on the body, and of course the mind. And gradually, those who enjoy sex life in their early age may suffer tremendously in their own later age with many diseases and problems. This has been proven, even by medical science. So we find that the animal propensities are there within the human being, but they must be regulated according to scriptural regulations. Yukta vihara viharasya, yukna chetasa karmeshu, yukta swapna vibodasya, yoga bhavati dukaha. Now, one who is temperate in eating, sleeping, working, and recreation can mitigate all material pangs by performing the yoga system. So the human being has these propensities too, but they are simply in order to keep the body and soul together. They're not meant to be simple forces of enjoyment. They're not meant for enjoyment. They're meant for simply a certain fulfillment of the human body. That is all. So, it is explained that the human goal of life actually is characterized by what is called higher intelligence. Higher intelligence. This is the quality the human beings have that the animals do not have. We have higher intelligence to discriminate between what is right and what is wrong, what is moral and what is immoral, what is meant for my welfare and what is meant for my destruction. On every level, the human being is meant to use his intelligence and discriminate. But of course, the human being cannot properly discriminate unless it has some understanding of what is the actual goal. So here, in this particular scripture, it says that human beings are meant for inquiring into the absolute truth. One should desire a healthy life for self-preservation only, in order simply to understand one's spiritual nature. So therefore, the scriptures in the very, very beginning say, Atato Brahma Jigyasa. Now that you have a human form of life, and try to understand who you are, and who is God, and what is your relationship with God, and how to act within that relation. It is explained in human society, we see that there's so many types of activities. And these are pretty much divided into four categories of directions. These are called four purusharthas. The first one is called dharma, artha, kama, moksha. These are basically the four activities of human civilization on the material platform, that is. What is dharma? Dharma means pious or religious activities. Giving in charity, performing welfare activities, becoming moral, following moral and religious principles. This is called dharma. And this frees one from basically the basic gross activities of sense gratification. There are three modes of material nature: goodness, passion, and ignorance. In ignorance, in those activities which are simply sinful, one cannot understand the goal of life, nor can one be happy in any sphere. You see, people or the living beings who simply try to enjoy gross bodily activities in the form of sense gratification, they live a very pathetic life. They're simply chasing after the animal propensities, and they're never happy. Eventually, they take to some various forms of intoxication and become victimized by distress and physical disabilities. And ultimately, their life is very short. This is the qualities of the modes of ignorance. A little higher than that is the mode of passion, where one works very hard, tries to maintain a very nice life, but simply wants to acquire material amenities in the form of sense gratification and what we might say material things. But in the higher modes, in goodness, it is explained that the human being lives simply for higher knowledge or understanding the pursuit of life, the goal of life. So one must come to the mode of goodness. From the mode of goodness, which is the highest of all the material modes, one can understand transcendence. One can understand God and one's relationship with God. So these four purusharthas are actually the evolution of human society. The first one, dharma, if you actually study the history of many societies as they developed from their very basic indigenous levels of existence, people would worship some kind of higher power. You see, the Aborigines, maybe they worship nature, or they worship some phenomenon within nature. or they have some understanding of some supreme being or higher controller, but no knowledge at all of what is the nature of that supreme being or higher controller. Society, it develops from basic moral and religious principles. So after that develops to a certain extent, you find, if you study the history of many civilizations, including this country, what happens after becoming a little biased? What did the forefathers came? They came from Europe, right? Europe and different parts of Europe. They came for religious freedom. What did they do? They came here and they established the different colonies. And they were protesting religious persecution, and they came for religious freedom. So there were so many diverse groups, all teaching that you can worship according to how you want to worship. And after setting a foundation of some religiosity, they saw the need for developing some social and material structure in order to carry on society. So gradually it became more complex. And then there were societies developing, of course families were there, and then smaller levels of government, and then higher up, and pretty soon you had the United States government. So after a while, some economic development. From religion comes economic development. From piety comes economic development. So, economic development is necessary in order to keep the body and soul together. One must have food, one must have a place to live, maybe some family arrangements. These are all necessary in order to live in this material world. But what is the purpose of all that? The purpose, as exemplified or as directed by material society, is to simply to enjoy sense gratification. Now we have a nice arrangement, now let us enjoy our senses. Let us create material things simply in order to satisfy the needs and demands of the senses. So you see, society goes to that level. And then there's a great push in order to make more life more convenient, more comfortable, more happy materially. So you find sometimes the Industrial Revolution was there. And then so much pushing, moving out west, the gold rush, expansion, and more little societies are springing up. And then gradually, and then what happened? And the wireless came, the telephone. And then after the telephone, there was, and then in the beginning of the 19th, and then they had the cotton gin, right? Before you pick cotton by hand, then they had a machine which could sort out the cotton even faster. So gradually, as society develops, they think of different ways to make life more convenient in order to deal with the external energy. And then after a while, Henry Ford comes along with the car. Right now we have a means for transportation. People don't have to walk anymore. And then, of course, it develops beyond that. And then sooner or later, televisions, computers, and so on. And you see how society becomes more and more directed to, in order to somehow or other, control the material energy in order to facilitate convenience and material sense gratification. And that's how society develops and can trace it out. But then what happens when it reaches a certain level of technological and industrial material development? As people become more and more comfortable, then they engage more and more of their time in trying to enjoy their senses. They take to more and more forms of material sense gratification. And as it explains here, in this particular purport, and as it explains in the Srimad Bhagavad Gita, that sense gratification cannot satisfy living beings. Because the senses and the body are not the actual living being. Living being is actually a spirit soul. So sense gratification is meant to be regulated according to one's position in life. And in no category of life can one go beyond the regulation of sense gratification without suffering. It is explained in the Sri Isha Upanishads that Ishavasha Migam Sarvam Yat Kichat Yat Tikam Chikat Tena Jaktena Bhunji Jaha Magudaha Kashiswidana, that everything in creation is owned and controlled by the Supreme Lord, and one must take their quota. And if one simply accepts their quota, one can live a very happy and healthy life, and one can aspire to live for many many years. As explained in the next verse, one can aspire to live for hundreds of years, if one lives according to their needs and means. If one goes beyond that, one is implicated in the laws of the material nature and is forced to suffer. If one goes less than that, then one cannot fulfill the goal of life. So the scriptures also give regulation for taking care of the needs of the body. What we see when economic development is simply geared for sense gratification, society becomes more and more directed towards that as the goal of life. And when that becomes the goal of life, then ultimately everything starts to go down, becomes more and more degraded. And people think of more and more ways, or continually trying to simply satisfy their senses. And when the senses are not satisfied, there's dissatisfaction, and when there's dissatisfaction, there are problems. As it says here, the politicians promise sense gratification for the voters. But what happens? The voters don't get their promises, so they dethrone the politicians. Or the family members. The husband is promising so much satisfaction for the wife, but the wife is not satisfied, and there's some divorce. Right? And vice versa. The children are not satisfied with sense gratification, so they leave. So on every level, everyone wants sense gratification. And that is a misdirected civilization, because this is not actually the goal of human life, to simply to try to satisfy the senses. So therefore, we see society is headed in a wrong direction. Simply trying to fulfill the needs of the body beyond the needs, and trying to enjoy the needs by consuming more and more types of sense enjoyment. And therefore there's frustration and disappointment. So, what happens? Next stage, when sense gratification doesn't become a source of satisfaction, when it reaches a certain level, it becomes degraded. It becomes violent. It becomes sadistic. It becomes very, very hellish human existence, a hellish civilization, where violence becomes a form of sense gratification. People are so frustrated and angry that they try to satisfy their senses by committing violence to other living beings. It's a form of enjoyment, a form of venting their frustrations. So you have so many groups that are based on violence and hate, we see in today's society. Again, frustrated sense gratification, misdirected civilization, missed the goal of human life. And then gradually, those who are a little bit intelligent, when they see that sense gratification doesn't satisfy them, where do they go? They take to some spiritual process and try to become one with God. They want to become free from the miseries of sense gratification and material living, but they want to merge into the existence of God and become one with God. They want to, as is explained here, they want to commit spiritual suicide. They want to stop suffering. Material life is suffering, sense gratification is miserable. So ultimately, let me merge into God, let me become one with God, let me free myself from the suffering, and then I can attain happiness. But this is also a wrong way, because ultimately the living entity is not meant to become one with God. He's meant to serve God in devotional service. So, we see those who are a little bit more intelligent, still, they make the mistake of trying to mitigate their misery by annihilating their existence. Or, by voiding out the activities of this world and simply taking to some kind of seclusion. Rejecting everything as being suffering, and not this, it's not this, it's not this. Let me simply just sit down and study or meditate and do nothing. And then ultimately, because the living entity is sentient by nature, they fall back down again to some forms of sense gratification and take up where they left off, because they can't do nothing. You have to perform some activities for either for the Lord or for our material energy. If you're not serving material energy, you're serving the Lord. If you're serving material energy, you're suffering. So ultimately, they have to come back to a position of suffering again. So these are the four activities that are mentioned in the scriptures, the four purusharthas. The four activities. religiosity, economic development, sense gratification, and ultimately liberation. But the scriptures say there is one, there's a fifth Purusharthra. It's called Purusharthra Siromani, which is, Siromani means crest jewel. It is the jewel of all the activities of the human society and is actually the real goal of human society. Atanto Brahmachigyasa, the human form of life is meant for self-realization. As this verse says, nothing else should be the goal of one's work. So yet, as we were explaining, there are so many other works to be done. But all these other things, maintaining society, family, country, and our body, are meant to be in conjunction or in support of this real goal. The fulfillment of all our desires and the goal of life is the same. Whatever aspirations and needs and ultimately happiness that the living entity is looking for is found in the fulfillment of the goal of life. In other words, whatever we're looking for is found in our relationship with God. When we look for it outside, we miss both the goal of life and the ability to fulfill our desires. They're synonymous. So this is explaining. So human life is meant for God realization. Because why? The living being is not a material entity. The living being is not a body. The living being has a body, but in the body there is a soul. Ajayate mirte vakudachin, nayam bhutva navabhuya, ajo nitya shashvato yampurana nahanyate hanimani sarire. The nature of the soul is that it is eternal, the nature of the body is that it is temporary. As Krishna told Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita, there has never been a time that you do not exist, nor I, nor all these kings on this battlefield, nor in the future shall you cease to be. So the very basic principle of understanding our goal of life is the understanding that we are actually a spirit particle and that we are eternal. We are not these bodies. This is the very basic principle. And to fulfill that goal of human life means to take up the process of self-realization. When the living being knows who they are, that is the beginning, then we have to fulfill that knowledge by fulfilling the goal of that knowledge. And that means developing our relationship with God. And he's explained, Nitya Siddha Krishna Prema, Savruka Gunai, Shravanadi Siddhi Chitti, Kodiya Yudoi. That the essential nature of the spiritual being is that within the heart of the soul, the essence of the soul, there is a natural love for God. And to reawaken that natural loving propensity is the goal of life. The living entity cannot feel satisfaction, nor can it stop repeating in the cycle of birth and death until it comes to that stage of perfect love of God. So, the scriptures, in so many ways, give so many injunctions for different categories of people according to different positions in life. But ultimately, they explain that there is a supreme goal. And that supreme goal is to develop love for Krishna, or love for God, Krishna and God. Thing. And that love is not something that is learnt or developed, it is something that is awakened. It's just like, use an example. If you have dust over the mirror, when you remove the dust, then you see that the mirror is actually reflecting. Prior to that, being covered by dust, the reflecting power of the mirror is gone. One cannot experience that. So as we remove the coverings of the material consciousness, which is due to the association of the material energy for so many lifetimes and so many species of life, we actually experience our natural attraction for God. A natural attraction for God. So to take up a spiritual process is natural. But when we look at the world, we find that 99.99% of the population are on the pursuit of material happiness and trying to satisfy the senses of the body. Of course, that has not always been the history. The tendency is that we live, or the situation is we live in a pretty degraded and materialistic time. So the tendency, the direction of all propaganda, of all activities, even religious societies, they teach that sense gratification is actually necessary. We say yes, in Krishna consciousness and devotional service, we say yes, sense gratification is necessary. You have to have sense gratification. But sense gratification is like salt. If you don't have, if your food doesn't have any salt on it, there's no taste. But if you put too much salt, then it's unpalatable and cannot eat it. So, therefore, the scriptures regulate the needs of the body, but with the desire, or with the emphasis, on raising our consciousness towards God, awakening our spiritual nature. And throughout the entire Srimad Bhagavatam, that is emphasized as the point. And if you read other scriptures, you'll find they're sometimes mixed with desires for sense gratification, desires for philosophical knowledge, desires for liberation. These things are there, but ultimately they're meant to, one is meant to go through that and ultimately come to the highest platform, developing one's love for God. So that is the actual goal of human life. Atato Brahmajigyasa. It's the first verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam. It has that saying, Atato Brahmajigyasa. Now, in the human form of life, try to understand God. Try to understand your relationship with God in devotional service. And of course, the process of devotional service is given by the acharyas, those who have achieved the goal of devotional service. And it's a given according to time, place, and circumstance. So in this age, the means for self-realization, or awakening one's consciousness towards God, is through the chanting of the holy names of the Lord. Krishna Varna Tuza Krishna Sangha Panga Saparshadam Yadnai Sankirtana Praya Yajanti Hi Sumedha Saha. That in this age, the means for self-realization is the congregational glorification of the Lord by chanting His holy names. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Lord Nityananda have come 500 years ago to give a very simple, sublime process of self-realization by applying Sabda Brahma, a transcendental sound vibration, on the material consciousness. Gradually, one awakens to their spiritual nature through this process of chanting the holy names of the Lord. So this is the means for self-realization. And of course, throughout the weekend, we'll explain a little bit more of these important principles. But today, I wanted to emphasize the importance of understanding the goal of human life, the rarity of the human form of life. To be born in a human being is rare. And to get a good birth, a good human being, is even rarer. And to be born in the land of Bharatvarsha, India, means to get a very special birth, because that birth means that one has performed devotional service in many previous lifetimes. So one has to understand very seriously the time that we have available in this human form of life, because the living entity can go down just like it goes up. It can go down. The evolutionary scale for the soul is situated in such a way, according to what we do and think and perform, that lays the foundation for our future. In other words, the living entity will get a birth in the next situation according to what it does in this life. And what we are in this life is due to our patterns in our previous life. So, it is very important to understand. So, those of you who have come, very wonderful, taking time out to understand the real goal of life. People are just wasting their time making money and doing so many other things, and they're forgetting their real form of goal of life, and they're trying to be happy in something that is not, cannot by its nature provide happiness. Happiness is something that is found internally, not externally. Externally, there are things that facilitate, but internally is where happiness lies. When the heart is satisfied, when the mind is peaceful, then one can be happy. And that can only be happy when one awakens to their spiritual nature. So this particular verse is very important. It gives the restriction that life's desires should not be directed towards sense gratification. In every species of life, the facility for sense gratification is given. And as we were discussing earlier, in all the other forms of life, the ability to enjoy one's senses are even more developed, and the animals are much more perfect at these things. The human form of life is not meant for sense gratification. It's meant for self-realization. So this is a very, very important verse here. Okay, so we can speak a little bit more, but I wondered if maybe we can stop here and see if there's any comments or questions. Yes, Dr. Ed? We had a history in our movement back in the early days where one of our devotees ran for president. And the reason why is not that we wanted to take some political office, but we found it an opportunity for a platform in order to make our philosophy known in a very widespread way. But generally, and not only generally, but historically, it is mentioned that persons involved in spiritual life do not get involved with politics. Because politics usually involve certain activities which are completely contrary to the nature of developing one's spiritual consciousness. So, in the history of the world, if you study Vedic literature, you'll find that there was a class of persons called the Brahmins, who were considered to be the spiritual heads of society. They would give advice to the kings and the rulers, but never to be directly involved with managing the politics, unless there was an extreme, extreme emergency. There was the one case in the scripture of Maharaj Venu, when he deviated so severely from Vedic culture and spiritual practice, the Brahmins took over and dethroned him and established political rule, and then they didn't take the post. They simply brought someone in who was qualified. So generally, persons engaged in devotional service stay away from that arena. But if people want advice, politicians should take, or heads of state should take advice from religious people, because they have to govern according to Manu Samhita. Manu Samhita is actually the law books for managing political affairs in a proper way, which is conducive to one's spiritual life. But generally we stay away from that, especially in today's age, where everything is so degraded. As soon as you enter into that arena, you have to give up many of your good qualities. So it's quite self-defeating. So we did run one person for president. His name was Balavanta. And with the idea of just using that platform in order to put forth our principles. But generally, not with the idea of taking over office. Okay? Is that clear? Okay. Okay. Anyone else? Any other questions or comments? Now, in human society, in order for human society to develop naturally, There is a system which is mentioned in the scriptures called Vanashram Dharma. Now, Vanashram Dharma is four orders of material life and four orders of spiritual life. The four orders of material life are Brahmins, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Sudras. Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, Chaturvarna Maya Srista, Guna Karma Vibhagasya, that according to the three modes of material nature and the work ascribed to them, four classes of men were created by me. So this Vanashram Dharma system is a natural system created by the Lord Himself. And there are persons who have brahminical tendencies. There are persons who have tendencies for martial spirit. There are persons who have tendencies for trade and for merchant. And there's generally a class of persons who are just workers. So these four propensities are there within society. So in order for society to develop naturally, there must be a regulation or a governing of society based on these four classes of men: Brahmins, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Sudras. So who can tell me what are some of the activities of the brahminical class? Does anyone know what are some of the brahminical activities? Yes. Teach. Teach what? Teach spiritual knowledge. Transcendental knowledge, spiritual knowledge, correct. Shastras. That is called patan patan, to learn the scriptures and to teach the scriptures. That's exactly right. Anything else? Yajyan yajyan, which they are? Yeah. So patan patan, as this young lady was saying, to learn the scriptures and to teach the scriptures. Yajan yajan, to worship the Lord and to teach worship of the Lord. And dana pratigraha. What is dana pratigraha? To give in charity and to accept charity. These are the six activities of the brahminical class. To teach, to learn to teach scriptures, to learn to teach worship, to accept charity, and to give in charity. These are the six activities of the brahminical class. What are some of the qualities of the brahminical class? Who knows? Peacefulness, tolerance, very good. Honesty. Humility. Yes. What are some of the ones mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita? That's there in all classes.
Knowledge.
Gentle. Knowledge. Cleanliness. That's there. Should not be atheist. Yes. There's many people who claim to be brahminical. What are the eight qualities of the brahminical order mentioned in Bhagavad Gita? We named some of them. One was tolerance. One was honesty. Knowledge. What's the other ones? Peacefulness. We named four. Cleanliness. Five.
Religiousness.
Yes. What, Jnanam Vijnanam means knowledge and wisdom. Two things. There's knowledge and there's also wisdom. Wisdom is realized knowledge. They should not only have knowledge but should have realization of the knowledge. And what is the one more?
Purity.
And I. Well, that's for everybody. All classes are meant for that. Austerity, so that. Sama. Equipoised. Sama. Sama means equal to all living beings. They see everyone equally. They don't make distinctions between this class and that class. Yes?
Okay, how does one find out that they realize?
I'm sorry?
How do you know that you have reached a stage that you have realized?
Well, when the sun is out, everyone gets benefit from the light. So everything is not judged theoretically, it's judged by practical understanding. So if you're eating and you start to think, well, am I full or not? Am I still hungry or not? You know. When you're satisfied, when you're full, you're done. So spiritual life is like that. It's an experience. It's not a theoretical thing. You know. Someone asked Prabhupada, have you seen God? Prabhupada said, if I told you, would you believe me? Unless you know the qualities of understanding one who can see God, how will you understand if that person can see God or not? So, it's an experience. Just like if you're looking for gold, you have to know what gold looks like before you can find it. So a person who is self-realized, here, okay, there's that verse in Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna asks Krishna, what is the activities of a self-realized person? How does he sit? How does he stand? How does he walk? How does he talk? What was the answer Krishna said? What was the answer to that? Does anyone know? Is there a Bhagavad Gita somewhere? Do we have one? Someone have a Bhagavad Gita? So there's Arjuna asked that in the third chapter, what is the symptoms of a self-realized person? And Krishna answered in the next verse. So everything can be understood by its symptoms. Third chapter? What are the symptoms of one whose consciousness emerges in transcendence? How does he speak? What is his language? How does he sit? How does he walk? Krishna says in the next verse, O Partha, when a man gives up all varieties of desire for sense gratification, which arise from mental concoction, when his mind finds satisfaction in the self alone, then he is said to be in pure transcendental consciousness. So the mind is full of desires for sense gratification. When one is free from the dictates of the mind, and his mind consciousness merged in transcendence, then he's considered to be a self-realized soul. Then he gives further description. One who is not disturbed in mind even amidst the threefold miseries, elated when there is happiness, who is free from attachment, fear, and anger, is called a sage of steady mind. No attachment, no fear, no anger. In the material world, one who is unaffected by whatever good or evil he may obtain, neither praising it nor despising it, is firmly fixed in perfect knowledge. One who is able to withdraw his senses from sense objects, as a tortoise draws its limbs within the shell, is perfectly fixed in consciousness. So these are some of the symptoms of a self-realized soul, or one who is merged in transcendence. But in order to tell whether someone else is there, you also have to have some elevation, some understanding yourself. Because one can really not see something that is beyond their own experience unless they understand. Just like we can't, people try to understand what is God, and they speculate, well, what is God? He's like this, or he's like this. But when you realize God, then you'll know God. You can't understand God unless you have realization of God. But a self-realized soul can be understood by his qualities. Also. At least to a very, very large degree. Humility, tolerance, patience, nonviolence, charity, simplicity, humility, cleanliness, freedom from fault finding, like that. Compassion. These are all qualities. When you see that, then you can start to understand a little bit more. Anything else? Okay, so these are Brahminical qualities. What are the qualities of a Kshatriya? We were speaking about the four orders of life. And, Sorry. Okay. That's basically their activities. They have two things. Who knows the word, what Kshatriya means? What is the actual word meaning? Anyone? Protect. Shut. One who gives protection from... Yes, welfare. Giving protection, looking out for one's welfare. These are all activities. Okay, so we will go right to the Bhagavad Gita. What are some of the qualities and characteristics of the Kshatriyas? Determination, resourcefulness. It says generosity. That's also charity. Leadership, heroism, power. Heroism, power, determination, resourcefulness, courage in battle, generosity, and leadership are the natural qualities of the work of the Kshatriyas. So here we find the second order of life, those who are meant to rule society and give protection to others. These are their qualities. And whenever there is some disturbance within society, they very strongly, without considering, deal with that in order to eliminate it. There's no Kshatriyas nowadays. Kshatriyas means to give protection. Srila Prabhupada was explaining, people cannot even walk the streets at night. Where's their protection? There's no protection. They don't give protection to the people. The rogues and thieves are everywhere. Dacoits are everywhere. There's no leadership. If Maharaj Parikshit was here, none of these would be able to. But there's no real Kshatriyas nowadays. People take up some kind of martial spirit, or they take up some kind of rule, simply in order to position themselves for more forms of sense gratification and control. Yes? Question?
So would the army, the army or the police be considered some form of protection?
Ideally, yes, but whether they do it or not is another question. But the military is supposed to give protection to the citizens, yes. Not simply for aggression. Kshatriyas doesn't mean aggressor. It doesn't say here anything about aggression. It means protection against aggression. So they live by moral and religious codes also. Not simply that they're good fighters.
So from ideally,
The actual understanding is they must live by, must be governed by religious principles, according to Manu Samhita and various religious scriptures. The Kshatriyas must be guided by the Brahmins. And the military and the rulers must be led by Brahminical principles. If there's no Brahminical leadership, then what you have is just power for the sake of power. You have exploitation, and that's what you have today. People don't consider, or governments don't consider, saintly, they have the separation of church and state. This is all artificial. It's all artificial. There was no question of separation of church and state. And everything, the church or the religious teachings were the basis for the military rule or for the government rule. Because these deal with the needs of the people. Material needs and spiritual needs both have to be there. Srila Prabhupada explains one of the duties of the government is to make sure that people can practice their religion without any disturbance. And that they also practice their teachings according to their scriptures. He explains that the leadership must allow people to practice and also to eliminate anything that's bogus, according to religious scriptures, too. I'll give you an example. I'll tell you a wonderful little story. It's a sweet little story. Prahlad Maharaj, when he was ruling, he was walking through his kingdom. He saw a sannyasi. And the sannyasi had a bow and an arrow. What is the sannyasi doing with bows and arrows? So he thought, this is a cheater sannyasi. Bunch of sannyasis don't carry bows and arrows for hunting. So what did he do? He challenged them to a fight. You're cheating, you're bogus. So they had a fight. So the fight went on for days and days and days, and nobody was winning. At one point, this is off the point, but this is the story anyway. At one point, Prahlad Maharaj wanted to defeat this so-called sannyasi. So he went to his deity, he prayed to his deity, and he offered a beautiful garland to his deity that day. And then he went out to challenge the sannyasi again the next day. When the sannyasi was coming towards him, he was wearing that same garland that he put on his deity. Ultimately, the sannyasi was Krishna. And then Prahlad Maharaj knew that this was actually his only worship of the Lord. That's a beautiful story. But the point was that when he saw some discrepancy, immediately he challenged that. When Maharaj Pariksha was touring his kingdom, he saw a low-class man beating the legs of a cow, a bull. And immediately he took out his sword. Five types of people need to be protected. Five classes of living beings require protection. This is the job of the Kshatriyas. The Brahmins must be protected. The cows must be protected. The women must be protected. Old people must be given protection. And children must be given protection. And these five categories of living beings are meant to be under Kshatriya's guidance, care, and protection at all times. And if someone offends them, or challenges them, or does something, tries to harm them, the Kshatriyas are supposed to take up defense and give them protection. That is the way it is. Well, what we see today and what is actually the ideal is quite different. So nowadays, not only is the Kshatriyas not giving protection and dealing with discrepancies, they are the dacoits. The leaders of our society who are supposed to give protection are the ones that are the criminals and rogues and thieves. And so what do you do? It's like an impossible situation. Right? Am I speaking beyond the reality, or do you disagree with that analysis? Is it a fact that those who rule the world today are... What is your opinion? Are they nice guys? What should we do? Well, you need Lord Ram to come back, I guess. Pray for the incarnation of Ram to come back and deal with all this stuff.
So who is the
There is none. Prabhupada says there's no first class men, which means Brahmins. There's no second class men, which is Kshatriyas. There's a few third class men. And most of the society is ruled and controlled by 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th class men. Third class men are the merchants, the mercantile people. And they're supposed to provide the food, trade, and agricultural needs of the society, deal with banking, raise and protect cows, like that. There's few mercantile men who take over the position of leadership. They become the government leaders. And what do? They use the leadership for their own sense credit, to make money. Kshatriyas are not allowed to accept charity. They're not allowed. They're supposed to collect taxes, but they're not allowed to accept charity. They cannot accept charity. They're supposed to give charity, but they cannot accept charity. But we see leadership is all based on big business, to align with the establishment, to make money. So instead of Raj Ram, you have Ravan or Raj. That is today's rule. The rule of Ravana instead of Ram. Yes? Kshatriyas were meant to stay in shape. So sometimes they would have to go out into the woods and practice their fighting. So they would sometimes shoot animals for sport. Like that. And there's some concession for eating meat. Kshatriyas. Not Brahmins, or not anybody following the spiritual process. In the spiritual process, one cannot eat meat.
What is the justification for killing the boar for
honor? Huh?
What is the justification?
Well, sometimes, and during peacetime, when there is no fighting, in order to practice, so they would go out and shoot and kill an animal. Why didn't they try?
Why don't they try on the Kshatriya? Why kill an innocent being?
Well, if there's no provocation, there's no fighting. It's not something that is indulged in for just out of frivolity or out of need. They do it for sport. And also there's restrictions in that also. But today you don't find Kshatriyas, so you don't... When you find these things, you have to see these things in relationship to the whole picture. If we look at one part and try to put it in, make it an ideal without the whole ideal life of the Kshatriya, and then it looks like it's wrong. When you have ideal Kshatriyas, then everything else works nicely. We don't have ideal Kshatriyas. So you follow that point? No? Okay.
Are there any Kshatriyas in the
Krishna
Council society?
Ideally, Srila Prabhupada wanted Vanashram Dharma established within our society. He started his movement by trying to create a Brahminical class. He worked on developing Brahmins. And that was his emphasis. He wanted to ultimately develop the entire Varnashram system, the Kshatriyas, the Vaishyas, and the supports. He didn't stay long enough to actually implement the system. But his teachings and his desires have been made known. He wanted that. So he left it up to us to follow through with these practices. But he laid the foundation. First you have to have the Brahmins. And then he came into the West where people have no training in any of the Varnas. They have no training in any of the Varnas. So part of our responsibility in Krishna consciousness is to educate people spiritually and to give them proper activities where they can fulfill their material needs. Train people to become Kshatriyas, train people to become good Vaishyas, and also train a class of people to support these others. So he wanted the Brahmins to do that. If you are enthusiastic, you can help organize the training of the Varnas. Yes, Mother?
So,
the Kshatriyas, they give charity,
but also Brahmins, they are supposed to get the
wealth and distribute it. Yeah. And then we mentioned that Dana Pratigraha, they accept in charity and they give in charity also. That's Brahminic, that's there for the Brahmins. The Brahmins do both. They accept gifts because Brahmins are not supposed to work. They're not supposed to work. They're teachers. The Brahmins are simply teachers. And they live on the support of the other Brahmins. Nowadays, people who are teachers, they sell their knowledge. But spiritual knowledge is not supposed to be sold. It's given freely to society.
But all the things have always been held in the Gopis of
the
I mean, the Gopis are always having all these seminars. There's always a fee.
A fee for the seminar?
Yes.
Well, you have to.
They have, even in my school, they have a seminar. I didn't go for the congregation teaching.
Ultimately, the idea is that the grihasthas, the congregational, are supposed to support these programs. So the support should come from, as explained, that Prabhupada explained that grihasthas are meant to be the financial support for the entire society. But when that's not there, then you have to do something in order to maintain it. Grihasthas are supposed to have responsible positions, make money, and support everything. That's the ideal. When you don't have the ideal, you have to somehow or other go along. So there are expenses, and when the money is not there, they have to do something in order to make up the difference. The congregation is supposed to support the preaching, ultimately. And meant for making money and using that money. The number one activity of the we have the Brahmins, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Sudras, and we have the four spiritual orders: sannyasis, grihasthas, brahmacharis, and vanaprasthas. Each one of them has duties. The number one duty of a grihastha. Not one of the duties, the number one duty is to give in charity. If a grihastha is not given charity, he's not a grihastha. So that's, grihasthas are supposed to be the support, the financial support for the entire society. And they make up the bulk of the members also. So like that. So that has to be there. So before we can speak ideally, we have to speak ideally in total.
So, what percentage of the income do we have to set
the
how much do we have to
give? The
grihasthas?
Yeah. Well, Prabhupada said, he used the example of Rupa Goswami. Now, people don't follow that because it's too strict. But Rupa Goswami, he was wealthy, so he gave his wealth, he divided it into three ways. He took 50% of his wealth and he gave it to support religious movements in the world, religious principles. He took 25% and kept it for personal expense, and 25% for emergencies. So 25% is saved, 25% is used, 50% is given for religious activities in the world. That's explained to be ideal. But people can't follow that. They say it's too much. I'm making $1 million a year. You want me to give you $500,000 a year? Too much. So, the second consideration is make some, do something. In other words, give some percentage. 10%, 5%, 1%. But do that. Whatever it is, regularly. Ideally, 50% is mentioned. But we don't push it because people feel that's too strict. So what we say is, do what you can. But whatever you're doing, do it regularly. It has to be charity and it must be given regularly. Because even if you follow the science of charity, you find that when you give, you get. There's a section in the scripture called the Dan Veda.
or the aspects of the Vedas that deal with the principles of charity. When you give money, you receive money. People know that. That's why people give money. They know, if you give money, I'll get money back. That's a fact. It works like that. There's a whole gradation. By giving to an ordinary person, you get twice as much back. If you give to a Brahmin, you get three or four times. If you give it to a qualified Brahmin, you get 100 times back. If you give to a pure devotee, you get it back unlimitedly. So that's mentioned also in the scriptures. So giving in charity doesn't mean you lose anything. You just become detached from the idea it's mine, because the understanding is everything belongs to God, and God gives me what I need, and I use what I need and take and give them whatever I can in order to support spiritual movements, spiritual principles, to worship God, in whatever form that may take. So that is the number one duty of the Grihastha community, is to give in charity. Okay? I think we're taking up a little bit less time. I don't know the actual schedule for the retreat weekend, but I think right after this is breakfast, so I'm sorry I took you beyond your breakfast point. Anyway, Prema Bhakti will make it known what is